Let's see. Okay, so I'm going to talk about basically going in the opposite direction from some of these discussions about how hard it is to resolve things inside a halo, and ask the question, well, can we actually get away without the halos and still define observables? Okay, I'll go into details why I want this, but basically, let me just remind you that the halo concept is a very useful theoretical concept, but it has to do with a somewhat theoretical idea of a virialized radius, virialized mass, and things like that. And the question is, so we use it because we think it has some relation to let's say, galaxies at the center of the halos. But the question is it the best possible way to define these things that we actually care about, which are the observables? All right, so can we define the galaxy observables without a halo concept? At some level, the answer has to be yes, we can, because if you take a hydrodynamic simulation, if you assume it has all the correct physics, it will produce anything you want, including galaxy stellar masses or whatever, without any knowledge of what the halo actually is. Right? So the question, more useful question is therefore, well, can we define the same thing at the level of dark matter simulations? Can we define anything we care to observe without ever running a halo finder? We actually have quite a lot of observable properties that we can use for this purpose. We can use density, which is perhaps smoothed at several scales. We can use momentum density. We can use momentum energy density, so v squares. We can use velocity divergence, we use tidal tensors. We actually have quite a lot of properties of the dark matter that are local, that do not require a halo finder, and that we can, in principle, use them to correlate against what we care about, let's say stellar mass, and define what we want. Now, we can also do this as a function of time, of course, right? We can actually write down evolution equations in terms of these variables that actually then give us, let's say, stellar mass or something like that. Okay, so the specific question that we are particularly interested in is basically, can we define these things out of very crappy simulations, which I'll define next what they are. Okay, so why we want this? Well, basically, from cosmology point of view, we want to have a correct, effective description of observables on large scales without necessarily getting into the details of what's happening on small scales, because we think we can't model small scales anyways. Okay, why do we want this? Well, perhaps that's simpler and easier to implement. You don't have to run a halo finder. It can be perhaps defined on very local over densities, below where the typical halo finder can find a mass, let's say below maybe 50 particles. Perhaps they are less scattered between the observable and whatever you can define than the halo mass is. There's no obvious reason why an observable, let's say stellar mass, the scatter of that one is the lowest against the halo mass. Maybe it's better to use maybe more local density, or maybe something that adds this additional information like the loss information and things like that. And finally, the concept that I find actually most important is the concept of differentiability. This is why we actually embarked on this project, is because we can't take the derivative of a halo finder easily at all. Let me explain that why this is so important. We want to do basically optimal large-scale structure analysis. And right now, the workhorse is basically running a two-point function of either galaxy clustering or dark matter, weak lensing, stuff like that. People have added a whole bunch of other statistics, three-point functions, voids, peaks counting, like clusters, topological measures, reconstructions. It's unclear how you would combine all of these things. And of course, all of these things are very non-Gaussian, so you need to get their covariance matrix and so on. All right, so the question is there a better way to do this? And the answer is, in principle, yes. We can actually do a full, complete analysis of large-scale structure, which guarantees you to give you all the information there is in large-scale structure. Okay. The reason we think we can do this is because we have a well-defined prior for the data. It's the cosmological power spectrum. S here, you can think of this as Fourier modes, linear Fourier modes. F of S is a mapping of these initial Fourier modes to whatever we observe, let's say galaxy luminosity or SZ or X-rays or whatever, weak lensing. And we think that that thing is usually well described with a Gaussian noise. And we can write down this kind of likelihood for the data given the model. All right, so the question is, you should think of this basically both and the data being in terms of millions to billions, right? Enormous parameter space here. Okay, so how do we solve this? Well, we need to maximize this posterior, basically. in this million or billion dimensional parameter space. Okay, so can we do this? Well, there's a curse of dimensionality. We can't just blindly search for a minimum, right? Or maximum, I guess, posterior. So we have to do something else. The standard way to do this, you know, in the optimization is to have a gradient, and the gradient will then tell you which direction to descend towards the minimum. I'm talking about a minimum here because I've taken log of that posterior and I get this kind of function, loss function, that I need to basically minimize. All right? So here's where the concept of the minimum, of the gradient comes in. In order to know how to descend down the hill to get to the minimum, we need to be able to take a gradient of our observations with respect to initial Fourier modes. All right? So that's where this concept of the gradient comes in. If we want to solve this problem, that's what we need. Okay, so in our methods, which I'll describe later, we use a BFGS optimizer. And, you know, as I said, it's based on a gradient. You really do need a gradient if you want to have any hope to solve for this. I'll just one slide on this gradient. How do you take a gradient of a full simulation? Well, you use the chain rule, pretty much. You take basically a gradient of every step that you do. What does it mean? Well, in the simulation, let's say take a PM simulation, it's a gradient of a kick and drift steps. You then and you have to backpropagate these steps in order to get the full gradient. That means you have to store all of the outputs, intermediate time steps, in order to do this backpropagation. Okay, it looks horrible, and to some extent it is. Clearly, if you want this to be feasible, you need to have very few time steps. All right, storing, let's say, 1,000 slices on a typical simulation, it's impossible, right? And then backpropagating. So low number of time steps is crucial, which then brings me to the next subject. How can we have, you know, accurate simulations with few time steps? We have developed this code called FastPM, which tries to do this. And the basic idea of this code is, well, let's try and make sure that we get the large scales right. That means that instead of having the usual kick and drift scheme, which is some, you know, symplectic Hamiltonian, based on symplectic Hamiltonians, we make sure that those kick and drifts are give you the correct Zeldovich solution. That guarantees that we get the correct linear growth of the displacements on large scales. Okay, and when doing this, then, you know, basically even with one step, we know we get the large scales right. So that's a minimum requirement if you want to make sure that the code, the cosmology code, gets something right, right? Because usually with, you know, with 5 or 10 time steps, you'd get, you know, 10% errors or something like that. Okay, so we developed this code. You know, it's basically quite fast compared to let's say 2LPT. It's only 7 times slower with 10 time steps, and against 5 time steps, it's really just 3.7 times slower. So you can really think of this as being sort of like not much slower than a 2LPT, but much more accurate, as I'll show next. So basically, you know, as I said, you know, here it's 5 time steps. You go from this to this. This, I believe, Elena has already shown. I don't, maybe in her 3-minute talk, but basically, with 5 steps, when we do abundance matched halos, our power spectrum compared to the fully resolved 3PM simulation, the error, you know, is only 1 or 2% at high K. So you know, even with 5 time steps, we can get, you know, 1 or 2% precision on the power spectrum. Okay, so that's good. However, here we're still talking about halos defined with the classical sense. In this case, it's a friends of friends algorithm. Okay, so let's move on. Let me just show you how we do this on the dark matter. The basic idea is, you know, we do this optimization. We have, in this situation, we had 230 calls. This is the final version. This is what we get after the 10 steps. You know, we get already pretty close to the final, right? But then 100 steps and then final reconstruction. That's on the final field, final nonlinear density field. On initial Gaussian field, you know, this is the 10 steps. This is 100 steps, this is reconstructed. You see that because we have noise, we don't do a perfect reconstruction. You see also how the power transfer is from large scale to small scales. You think that you have done a perfect reconstruction here on the final, and yet the initial modes are not perfectly constructed. Okay, that's mostly because a lot of the power that you see here is actually power transfer from large scale to small scales. Okay, so what do we do with this map? We try to integrate it out, the small scale modes. Okay, so basically we have these billions or millions of modes. We have too much information. What do we do with it? It's not very useful. Some people try to sample this thing, but Sampling in this million-dimensional parameter space is really hard. The samples are very correlated. Even if the acceptance rate is high, this correlation length is very strong. So basically, you know, typically they need 1,000 simulations to get one independent sample. So, you know, clearly this is not the way to go. Okay, so, but the, you know, sampling really, the way to think about this is like doing molecular dynamics simulations for a very large problem of, I don't know, let's say gas or something like that. We don't do that usually. We do statistical mechanics. What does statistical mechanics do? It integrates out the microscopic degrees of freedom, typically via multivariate Gaussian integrals. Okay, so that's what we do. We try to integrate basically these modes out. We get something that looks like likelihood of the data given the models now. So we have integrated out the microscopic degrees of freedom. We get something that, you know, still depends on the data in a very, you know, somewhat complicated way. And then what we do, we expand this likelihood to the second order and use Newton's method basically to define where the maximum is, and use the Newton's method to define also the Fisher matrix, which is the covariance matrix for this problem. All right, so that's the basic idea. I'll just go, so, you know, final estimator is basically just this reconstructed modes squared, okay? That's the estimator. It's actually a very simple estimator. You just have to add up, let's say you want to estimate the power spectrum in some K range, you just add up all the squares of all the reconstructed modes within that K range. That's all you need to do. There's some more work to do to get the Fisher matrix out of this. I won't go into details, but basically that's what we are doing. And then the final result is shown here. Again, this is just for the simple case of dark matter. And here is, for example, our reconstructed power spectrum. You see how we lose power at high K because we have noise. But then when this method corrects for it and gets the correct reconstruction, which is shown here, and so these are the black points with the errors, obviously, because these are, you know, final volume, noise, and so on. But the point I'm trying to make is this reconstructs the fully linear power spectrum with all the BAO wiggles in the linear case. The green line is the nonlinear wiggles. You see how they smoothed out, but the reconstruction actually reconstructs the linear ones. So it does what it's supposed to do. And here's the window matrix, which shows how the modes get correlated at high K because of the mode coupling. Okay. All right, so this approach basically allows for unified approach to all of the large-scale structure methods. You can add any data you want. The one question for this, for me at least, that I want to get out of this audience here is basically, what is the best tracer? What tracer correlates with the dark matter properties best? Okay, so which one has the least scatter? Is it stellar mass or is it something else? So that's one question. And the other question is, of course, do we want to look at the correlation against the dark matter halo mass or something else? Right? Those are the two, I guess, interesting questions that we still don't have completely clear answer to this. But basically, you know, once you have some kind of forward model and probabilistic description of data with some noise description, then you can basically just plug this into this machinery and use any data set you want. Okay, so going back to the original question, so this was motivation basically to ask the question, how do we make galaxies differentiable, right? You know, if you look at the galaxies, they're pure point discrete process, so that's not easily differentiable. Halo finders are equally complicated, you know, friends of friends or whatever, you know, peak finders in phase space or something like that, that's not easy differentiable. So we want to do something which is much simpler and still tries to give us something that we can take a gradient of, basically. All right, so in our first attempt, we will use just the density field, smooth it on a couple of smoothing scales. And by the way, this work is done with Chirag Modi, who also has a poster out there. And we'll try to connect to the halo mass, which I, you know, previously argued, well, maybe we don't even need the halo mass. But if you want to, you know, prove that this concept works, why don't we, you know, try to connect it to the halo mass? This way we'll at least have some idea how well we do against the traditional methods, right? And then, of course, in the second step, we correlate halo mass to the observable, like stellar mass or something like that. Okay, again, maybe getting galaxy observables may be easier, I don't know. Okay, so here is an example of the scatter plot as a function of halo mass put at the centers. Basically, what are the overdensities in these kind of simulations? At three different smoothing scales, 1, 1.5, and 2 megaparsecs. And you see basically how higher mass has higher density at that position. Again, this is gridded density field, all right? So that's why, and these are, since the grid cells are 4 megaparsec, that's why you never, we don't get enormously large over densities. But you see there's some relation between halo mass and this parameter. Now, if you have a typical galaxy sample, what will happen, they'll have a threshold, right? There will be no galaxies below, let's say, 10 to the 13 or something like that. In order to implement this, we use the sigmoid mapping, which is just a logistical regression function, which is basically just a smooth version of a step function, right? Smooth so that we can take a derivative of. All right, that's what we do. Here is an example of this. So this is our sigmoid thresholded field at, I believe, 5 times 10 to the 13 solar masses. And this is the halo catalog as run by the traditional halo finder. And you can see basically the agreement is reasonably good. On a log scale, it's still quite good. This is taking a log of this thing. So this has a huge dynamic range. OK, in terms of two-point statistics, we get basically, because we are predicting where the halo positions are, we get a noise which is much lower than the Poisson shot noise. OK, so for example, the dashed lines here are the Poisson shot noise, and these things are usually of an order of magnitude lower than that. And in terms of the transfer function, so how well the power spectrum we get perfect agreement on large scales, at least for the lower masses. And then we get some smoothing because these things have finite structure. They're kind of smoothed, softened, right? Because they're not as localized as the dark matter halos are with the traditional halo finders. Okay, so far this was all done on Gadget. We haven't done it yet on FastPM. We'll see how that works on a crappy simulation that we really want to use ultimately. Okay, so this is all I wanted to say about this thing, but inspired by those talks this morning, I wanted to say two things, which I hope will be inspiration for discussion later. One is a plot that we have produced with Yu Feng, which was, we have looked at basically bias as a function environment, and we have ranked the halos by proximity to each other, and then we split them into those that are close to each other and those that are far away from each other. So if I take, for example, halos which are in the mass range between 12 and 12.5, and I split by proximity, those that are closer to each other, those that are within 5 megaparsec of each other, and the rest, then, and if I look now at the bias of these two samples, the crowd field, those that are close to each other, bias doesn't change very much, all right, but the one that are, that avoids other galaxies is changing drastically. At 5 megaparsec, we already have a bias 0, and this is about 15% of the sample. So this is very similar to what Simon was showing earlier, right? But it's just that here it's more explicitly just environment density, or one definition of environment density. And then, of course, if you go to, let's say, 10%, you already get negative biases. You see, bias can be anything you want, really, in the negative direction. Right? You're getting more and more into these voids. Okay, so that's one thing. So this raises the question, is this effect, as Simon was already showing, this environmental effect is much stronger than any assembly bias effect. And this raises the question, is assembly bias history needed? This is the question I asked earlier, and I hope there will be some discussion of this. And let me just answer my own question here is, I believe it is, and I believe the evidence comes, interestingly, from simulations of promoting non-Gaussianity. And since maybe not everybody is familiar with this, what promoting non-Gaussianity people have shown is that basically promoting non-Gaussianity people have shown, like Neil Dalal have shown, that there is a response, scale-dependent bias response to promoting non-Gaussianity of regular galaxies. Right? It goes as Lagrangian bias, basically, B minus 1. Okay, so that result has been known since 2006. But what we have shown is that if you take a recent, if you look at the merger history of these things, it turns out there is this B minus 1 can change to B minus 1.6 can change basically, depending on your merger history. In particular, if you have recent mergers, this bias effect goes to, from one B minus 1 to B minus 1.6. And this thing has been actually verified by Reed et al. In this paper, where they basically split the halos into young and old halos as a function of, as I said, merging history, and they showed that the bias difference can be enormous. And this truly is, I believe, assembly bias history, right? I mean, it has to do really on the mergers. This effect is non-existent at all for the regular bias. It's only there for the primordial non-Gaussianity bias. Okay, so I just wanted to, you know, bring out this as a perhaps a topic of discussion, and then, you know, I leave it the open questions here.
Questions. Alexi. You're at the beginning, you mentioned some idea that maybe the galaxy properties might be more correlated with like a small scale halo density instead of the real radius density. It seems like that would be interesting to go and test in hydro simulations. I was wondering if you had any plans or thoughts about that.
Yeah, so, you know, yes, indeed, I did motivate that, and it kind of makes sense. Of course, this is not where our interest is, because we want to get everything out of these very crappy simulations with five time steps. Clearly, we cannot resolve anything inside a halo in that case, right? And in fact, we have to do the opposite. We have to use the, you know, features that are outside the halo and hope that maybe they correlate with that. But yes, to answer your question, this should be looked at, whether, you know, low density at scale smaller than VLA radios correlate better and things like that. I'm not aware of any work, but yeah, it should be done.
So you define this likelihood after you did the integration of the micro, the small stuff. And then you described how you do the minimization or the maximization of the likelihood, and it seems that that works nicely if you have a unimodal likelihood surface, but
right.
Isn't it a horrific multimodal surface?
You mean several local maxima?
Several is a large number.
There's an interesting discussion about this, raging actually in the machine learning community, because so in the past there hasn't been that much work on this multi-million dimensional space. So one thing that is emerging out of this discussions is that it's actually very hard to build a wall in multi-million dimensions. If you think of it in the context of random matrix theory, you know, if you do a random matrix, most of the eigenmodes, most of the eigenmodes will be saddle points. Most of the places where you have extrema are saddle points, not local minima, right? It's very hard to have direction, basically to build a wall in many dimensions, right? So what happens is this, yes, you get stuck on a saddle point, you struggle there for a while, then you realize it's a saddle point and you drop down again, and then you keep doing this until you hope you have converged, right? Now at the bottom, it is true, at the bottom there are local minima, but they don't matter. And it don't matter because, there's a way, simple way to understand this. Once you're at the bottom, you know, really the posterior volume is all very far from the bottom, and it actually doesn't matter where you are at the bottom. So that's my hand wavy argument. Why? I hope this is not going to be a major issue, but I definitely agree this needs to be proven.
So in terms of the deconstructing linear Gaussian mode, what determines the maximum wave number you can access?
Sorry, in terms of what?
Recovering the linear Gaussian mode. You nicely showed that you can recover the linear plus spectrum, right?
Yeah.
So what determines the maximum wave number you can access?
Well, in this model, it's a deterministic model, so it's noise. Noise is the only thing that corrupts your reconstruction. If you had no noise, the reconstruction would be perfect. So the answer to your question depends then on the level of noise. Right.
The model, right?
Sorry?
The model.
So far I've assumed the model is perfect. Now, of course, there are also nuisance parameters. We don't know the astrophysics on small scales. We have to put in baryonic effects. We have to put in all sorts of stuff that we think we don't have under control. And ultimately, I assume those things will be more important. But, we'll have to see. At the level of dark matter, if you don't think baryonic effects are important, then you could, in principle, and you had perfect data without noise, you can in principle reconstruct everything. You know?
Any other comments or questions? If not, let's thank Roche again.